Stop punishing yourself with bland, chalky protein shakes and fuel your fitness with the best protein in the game at GNC. We've got the hottest brands and flavors that legit taste like cookies, your favorite cereal, indulgent desserts, and more. It's on at GNC.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff. This is the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the groupies, the wives, the girlfriends, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves.
They were sweet, sexy, brave, and powerful. They went after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and hello, Lynx.
Hello.
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 How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You smell so good today.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I already told you that, but I want everybody to know that Lynx smells so good.
I appreciate it.
Just like David Bowie.
Ooh. Yeah, freshly showered.
Well, welcome to the show. Today, we are going to be discussing the book Touching from a Distance, which was written by Deborah Curtis, who is the widow of Ian Curtis from Joy Division.
Mm-hmm. I've seen the movie a long time ago. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to getting the details from you.
Yeah. Lynx was flipping through the book and she was like, I really want to read this, but I don't read for pleasure anymore.
It's a lot of work going through all these books and going online and searching for, you know, more information. Like all of our time is spent on whatever episode we're working on that week.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the movie that you mentioned is called Control, and that movie was based on the book from Deborah Curtis. So just because you saw the movie like I did, and if you were like me and you watched it over and over and over and over again and over and over again, then you'll still be able to learn something from this episode because there are some big differences between the book and the movie.
As usual, films tend to jazz things up a little more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so it'll be interesting to talk about the parts that they actually did jazz up. Mm-hmm. So just before we get into the episode, I think it's important to just let everybody know if you're familiar, if you're not familiar with Ian Curtis, he did commit suicide at a very young age. And so we will be talking about that and about everything in his life that pretty much led up to that point and about some of the things that he was going through. So just a little bit of want to let you guys know.
A heads up.
Just want a heads up. Want to look after you.
Go on.
Okay. I used to own this book and I lent it to my dad. And so I had asked my dad not too long ago, or maybe a couple months ago, because I was planning on doing this episode. I was like, do you still have the book about Ian Curtis from Joy Division? And he was like, no, I don't have that anymore. And I was like, did you like it? And he was like, no, I didn't. And I didn't know why, because I had seen the movie a bunch of times, but I only read the book once, and when I was in university. And when I reread it, I realized why he didn't like it so much. And it's because it's really depressing.
Yeah.
It's really sad. Mm-hmm. But not in the way that you might think that it is. Like, you might think that it's really sad because you have all of this like sympathy for Ian Curtis. Mm-hmm. Actually, you read the book and it tells a completely different side of him that the movie only skims the surface on.
Oh.
The movie really, really idealizes, like, it's, you know, the romanticism of him, and especially his relationship with Anik. Mm-hmm. But it was actually really awful, a lot of the things that he did to Debbie.
Yeah.
And her book doesn't come off as one that's like angry or like any kind of like blaming, or it's just matter of fact.
Yeah.
She just presents these like he would do this and he would do this and so on. So I went back and I read it again and I went, oh, this is an absolutely sad book.
Yeah.
And I was telling a coworker about it. Yeah, I was reading this book, Debbie Curtis, Ian Curtis's wife, and he was like, Debbie Downer. And I was like, oh yeah, it's true.
Every woman named Debbie,
poor Debbie,
hates that.
Yeah. Or as they call her in Maxfield, Debbie.
Debbie.
Okay. So right as you get into the book, there's a foreword by a man named John Savage. And right off the bat, he says, Ian Curtis was singer and lyrics writer of a rare mediumistic power. His songs and performances for Joy Division conveyed desperate, raging emotions behind a dour Mancunian facade, like Manchester, mm-hmm. Mancunian. But I really was attracted to Joy Division and in particular to Ian Curtis because of that mediumistic presence that he had. Oh, the yeah. eyes that are so clear blue that are just almost seem outer worldly, or the way that he would work himself into an almost trance. Like, it was one of the first when I was in university artists that I saw who really just seemed to leave themselves.
Yeah. His stage presence is unbelievable.
Yeah, so yeah. She talks a lot about the escalation of that stage persona. Mm-hmm. And pretty much in terms of the sicker Ian got, the sicker his dancing got, but the more people wanted it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that always the way? So many artists... we have a sick fascination of watching people destroy themselves. Amy yeah. Winehouse is another great example of that. No one could look away, but it was sort of obvious that something is off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ian Curtis was always attracted to that from a very, very, very young age. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I had read to you when we were at Massey Hall the other day is I had the book with me and I opened up the book and I went, listen to this. In the intro, again, it says, this book also tells us something that is ever present but rarely discussed. The role of women in the male, often macho world of rock. Deborah Curtis is the wife who supported her husband but who got left behind.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It really wraps it up.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to do here with muses and stuff.
Mm.
Telling their stories.
Yeah. So Debbie talks a lot about Ian, of course, and she said he never did anything in halves. Any interest became a vocation. Like we were just saying, all of Ian's heroes, well, most of them besides David Bowie and Lou Reed, were dead. His fascination with dying young was ever present even in the beginning of Debbie and Ian's relationship. She thought that he was going to grow and mature out of that as he started to realize some of the things in life that, you know, like marriage and maybe children and some of the things that life had to offer. Mm-hmm. He even bought a red jacket like James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh, Lordy.
Yeah, and this is a fun fact that I did learn, the only fun fact in the whole book, that he had gotten backstage at a David Bowie concert, and he had asked for autographs from David Bowie and Mick Ronson, and so he was quite a groupie himself.
Absolutely.
He idolized them until he emulated them.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. yeah. So he was really obsessed with this certain level of fame, and he really pursued it. Debbie often called him, mentioned that he was an actor, and he saw himself as one in a play, and everybody else around him were just a part of that. They were there. He was very much always wanting to be the center of attention. He always wanted people to be looking at him. He liked to wear makeup. He liked to experiment with clothing. She said that besides music, his other love was clothing and buying clothes, which you think is kind of weird because every picture you see of Ian Curtis, he's in the drab green. I feel like it was only right at the beginning
like a showman,
flamboyant. Yeah. He really wasn't, but apparently he was dressed like that at the beginning. One of the first times they hung out, he was wearing this pink little fuzzy jacket that belonged to his little sister.
Interesting. I guess he really did want to be Bowie. Yeah,
yeah, he did want to be Bowie. And then there's also something that I'll get into a little bit later about my, like, questioning of his sexuality a little bit.
Okay.
Okay. So in terms of Debbie, before she met Ian, she had a pretty chill childhood growing up in the 60s. She said it consisted of looking for bird's nests and feeding orphaned lambs.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah. In 1972, before they met, Ian was hanging out a lot with his friend Tony Nuttall, and you'll remember this from the movie if you've seen it. They were taking a whole bunch of household drugs and sniffing all kinds of solvents to the point where both of them ended up having to have their stomachs pumped.
Oh, lovely.
So they would go to, like, seniors' homes and spend time with old folks, and one of them would excuse themselves to the bathroom, and the other one would, like, steal the medication, and they would just get ripped. And, you know, it makes me wonder if, like, the early, you know, messing around with medication that causes paranoia and apathy and blurred vision and all that kind of stuff, if it could have contributed to his eventual, you know, mental health decline.
I'm sure it didn't help.
Dual personality to the point of, like, Debbie and his friends would call him, like, a depressive schizophrenic.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it could have been a thing that triggered from a young age. So he and Debbie were together in 1972, 1973, and they'd start to go to parties together. And there's some pretty funny stories about the weird parties that they would go to. Like, they'd all get into showers together, like, a bunch of them. And
I have stories like that.
Yeah. Oh, really? No. I don't. Just kidding. Of course we do. We all do. Oh, I mean, speaking of, another reason why I was really into Control and really into Ian Curtis in the time that I got into Joy Division and everybody was because I was kind of in a relationship with a traveling musician, as much as you can be somebody who's a traveling musician who has a girlfriend, and I was very young, and it was very much that sort of like romantic, dark feeling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's interesting how that's so romantic and desirable when you're like 19, 20 and you think that's like attractive, and then you grow older and you're like, what the hell was I doing?
Yeah.
Yep.
So when they were together, she learned very early on that he was obsessed with Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison, and she said that Ian had no interest in living beyond his early 20s. Untrue. He was 23.
Yeah.
When he killed himself.
Yeah.
She said that she took it with a pinch of salt. She spent a lot of time with Ian at this point and talks about his inexplicable temper tantrums. He would freak out at parties and people would have no idea where his anger would come from. And all of a sudden he would just be putting his hand through a window.
Oh, I thought you were going to say just like suddenly was calm again.
No. And then I again wrote repressed homosexuality. And I mean, there's a part of me that thinks like almost everybody is repressing homosexuality, because I'm like, a part of me is like, everybody's a little bit gay though. Like, it's just, Lynx is kind of over there going,
I mean, I know people who would disagree with that.
So I do think, I'm just saying this is my opinion. This is just what I think. You don't have to agree with me and you don't have to disagree with me. I just have a thing where I'm just like,
I agree with you in the sense that it's hard to believe that everyone is like a 10 on the straight meter.
Oh, you know? Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And hey, if he grew up admiring people like Bowie and Lou Reed and stuff, that absolutely, he had to have questioned that part of
growing
them
up in London in like the late 60s and early 70s, where like even if he wanted to be, like, it couldn't happen. Like, not really. unless he got out of Macclesfield. And
yeah.
Anyways. If you have any thoughts about Ian Curtis's repressed homosexuality, please feel free to chime in this conversation. So, he did have another part of him that was gentle. He possessed a thoughtful sincerity, which shows the double personality that he did have within him mm-hmm. early on. Debbie did not like drawing attention to herself. So on the other hand, when he's experimenting with the makeup and the scarves and all that stuff, she really didn't want to be the center of attention. And she thinks that that's one of the main assets that she had for Ian, that she was an accessory and there was little danger of her ever outshining him.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, like, what Ian was attracted to in Debbie? If he was so out there and she was so inward.
Yeah.
But that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. When they really started dating, he convinced her to not go to school. He started displaying some, I would call it, abusive tendencies, in terms of really starting to control her, not allowing her to wear skirts. She wasn't allowed to wear makeup anymore. At a Lou Reed concert in 1973, he dragged her around, and he even brought her into the men's washroom.
Oh my God.
With her. So he was very, very possessive.
Yeah.
And when she was working at lunchtime, he made her go home to his parents' house for lunch. So if her lunch was an hour, she spent half of it commuting to his mom's house.
If you're a woman out there and your man is trying to control what you wear and everything, it's not worth it.
Like, I'm not opposed to your mother making me lunch, but
yeah, exactly,
it has to be for the right reasons.
Yeah, that's not love, that's manipulation.
That's control. It that's a good word.
Yeah,
control. Yeah, there's a lot of weird control stuff happening. Yeah. Here he started cutting her out of her friend groups.
No,
but he wouldn't really include her in his own either.
Yeah.
Then on the other hand, he would read her Oscar Wilde poems and cry.
Yeah.
He would take her on long, beautiful walks, and they ended up becoming engaged.
Yeah, those beautiful moments the women tend to idealize and say, well, this is the real him.
Yeah.
Like, maybe I can change him eventually, but he'll grow out of it.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah. It's a cycle. I'm sure a lot of people can relate.
Yeah. For Valentine's Day in 1974, he wrote her a poem about a dream he had of her walking on a lonely beach, deserted, which ended up coming true in June of 1980 when she was on holiday with her parents after his death. Aww. So he kind of had
a premonition.
He did. Yeah. They got engaged April 17th, 1974, and he chose all of the people to attend the engagement party, which excluded a lot of her friends.
Yeah.
Her family was there, but when she ended up dancing with her uncle, he got so mad that he ended up throwing tomato juice on her face and all over her dress.
Oh my God.
At their engagement party.
Oh my God. That's when you break up. That's when you don't get married.
Yeah. But then the thing is, too, like, we get late, like, we're skipping ahead a little bit. But a part of the tumultuous relationship he had with his wife and then with the inclusion of Anik.
Yeah.
That's where Joy Division got their fuel. That's where the lyrics came from. That's where the gloomy atmosphere came from. And atmosphere. Let's see how many Joy Division songs we can name just in casual conversation during this episode. And so, you know, Debbie really takes a look back at everything, and it was almost like he crafted this persona, this myth of himself to be this certain kind of person with, of course, very real and very severe mental health and then eventually the epilepsy. So it was almost like this, like, which came first and everything fed into everything.
Mm-hmm. In the book I'm reading in an episode that's going to come up in the future, it's also a type of abusive relationship, like manipulation and all of that. And it makes me wonder, a lot of rock stars, a lot of artists do have like a troubled psyche, if you will. And it's an interesting thing. We do tend to romanticize that, like they are a great artist because they are troubled.
Yeah.
I wonder if by having that sort of thought, we're actually doing them harm by not taking it more seriously. And they tend to surround themselves with people who indulge them when they are like that.
She does mention that he was very involved, that Ian was in a fairyland, mm-hmm. and they just let him stay there.
Exactly.
So every time he would get into this mood, they would just compare him to one of his heroes. Yeah. And he would like it and then be pacified.
Exactly. Exactly. And in the end, that's not good for them or the people around them.
And I feel like people who really idolize Ian Curtis, which I know that there must be.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right? And yep. People who, and even I did, and even I, like, just watching the movie and just getting the impression of him based on the movie and like, oh, poor him. They might not like what we're talking about because Debbie opens up this whole other can of something that is like, okay, well, actually, this is what was going on in this.
It's hard to hear that your heroes aren't perfect, but they are human. And like we said, like a lot of artists are troubled. They have dealt with a lot of issues. And
he was 23 years old, like in 1980. How do you process that? How is, like, what it even is that world anymore?
Yeah.
I just watched an Instagram story of a Backstreet Boy playing golf.
Yeah. Oh, Lordy.
Okay. Where were we? Okay, so he was dancing at their engagement party and refused to dance with Debbie. He danced alone, and his movements were reminiscent of his later moves that were to become his stage presence. So this was a good year even before he was diagnosed with epilepsy, but this was starting to come out, and who knows, like they were probably drinking a lot, fueled by alcohol, but Debbie's family definitely thought that he was on drugs.
Yeah. If you haven't seen Ian Curtis perform, just Google or YouTube. It's incredible.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
But now that I know, like, almost how much damage it caused him every time he did that, it's, like, it's almost, like, difficult to think about and watch it. And anyways. She said that they went to a wedding in Liverpool, and he forbade her to dance. She did anyway, but on the way home on the train, he forced her to make love. She said, by now I was used not only to Ian's jealousy and possessive attitude, but also his particular brand of retribution. I felt he was reestablishing ownership.
Jesus.
And on that note, they were married on August 23rd in 1975. She says, initially, Ian was reluctant to marry me in a church. He predicted I would be struck down as I walked down the aisle.
Wow.
I know. What the fuck?
That's a sign of mental illness right there.
The night of the wedding, he told Tony Wilson's first wife, Lindsay Reed, that he thought about canceling the wedding because he knew in his heart that he would eventually be unfaithful.
People who know that should not get married. If you already, like, decided that you're going to be unfaithful,
yeah,
you should not get married.
Or, like, have a conversation like, so, you know, a couple years down the line, we want to open this up or what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's be a progressive 2017 couple. I don't know. Okay. So, she took care of everything. His finances, and as long as he had cigarettes, he might as well have just been living at home. Like, mm-hmm. when he was at home, he did nothing for himself. When he lived with his wife, he did nothing for himself. He had no intention of learning anything practical. He didn't want to get his driver's license. He was just wanting to be a rock star. That, like, we'll get you money someday. We'll make sure that I can pay for this someday. Like, mm-hmm. just wait. So, they saw Iggy Pop in Manchester in 1977, and everyone was freaking out, jumping on seats, dancing around, and she said he was surprisingly still. So you can imagine that he's watching that, probably enjoying it, but probably not because he wants to be there so badly.
Or maybe studying.
Studying.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, that's a good way to think of it, too, because
Iggy Pop's definitely his on stage dancing and everything. There's definitely some Ian Curtis there. Like, you can see he got some of his moves from Iggy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She talks about after having an argument. She says, he turned around, brought two long hands up and put them around my neck, just tight enough to render me immobile. So it's the only time that she talks about physical abuse, but
it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it was around this time that the band got together. Peter Hook, Bernard Mason. Oh, I must have got that name wrong. And Terry Mason. Bernard Sumner, I believe his name is. And Terry Mason. Terry later became the manager, but then was replaced by Rob Gretton. And I remember there's that funny scene in Control where he's like, what's your name? Terry. Terry what? Terry Mason. And he was like, Terry Mason? I've never heard of you. Oh, fuck. I did that. That was brutal. I shouldn't. Cut it out. Links. Cut that out. Yeah, so Rob Gretton came in and he ended up being their manager eventually. But on May 29th, 1977, Warsaw played their first gig at Electric Circus. The Buzzcocks were also on that bill.
Nice.
So they got a pretty good review from Enemy, who said that they were still learning to play their instruments, but that I liked them and will like them even more in 6 months' time.
Hmm. Yeah.
I love Enemy magazine.
I used to read that a lot.
The only place I could ever find it was at the downtown bus terminal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they don't sell it anymore. So I don't know if there's anywhere in Toronto that sells Enemy magazine.
I used to get it at a big bookstore by my place, but that's not there anymore either.
Oh.
Bookstores are just
obsolete.
Yeah. It's so depressing.
Just take your Instagram and your Kindles and your open marriages.
Anyway.
Let's go back to 1977. I can't take it. Did you see, actually, on Instagram, I don't know if her Twitter handle is, like, 60s groupie, or, like, we follow so many great groupie accounts, but her bedroom is, like, straight out of the 1960s.
Oh, yeah, I saw.
And she just got that awesome, like, makeup table, and her room is, like, painted this pale pink, and...
I love... Instagram for that. There's so many amazing dolls out there that
are just like living and breathing. They're like, I don't care that I'm in 2017. Yeah. My bedroom looks like I'm in 1960s, but I'm gonna Instagram it. So
get to like live
the past and the present coming together to make something not quite as good as okay.
So Joy Division.
Yeah, Ian started writing in his room, his blue room. He painted blue. And Debbie said that he would close himself up in his room smoking and drinking coffee and that she didn't mind the situation. We regarded it as a project, something that had to be done. Neither did I inspect his work. I never doubted that his songs would be anything but superior. So she was very, very supportive. They'd be at parties, and this is like before Joy Division is like playing any shows, but she did mention that she would find him like kissing other women, and it was a sign of things to come pretty early on in their marriage. His onstage antics were quite volatile. He would rip off tiles and throw them at the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Their first record came out in December of 1977, and their last gig as Warsaw was on New Year's Eve of 1977. There was already a London-based band called Warsaw Pact, and then the Warsaw name was based off of the David Bowie song.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the essential ingredient for any new band name was that it had to be shocking.
Yeah.
Ian told Debbie that Joy Division was what the Nazis called female prisoners kept alive to be used as prostitutes for the German army.
Mm-hmm.
She thought it was gruesome and tasteless, and she hoped that no one understood the true meaning. With the way that they dressed, the sleeve of the EP, the umlaut that they used, pictures of Bernard that made him look like a member of the Hitler Youth, there was a lot of suspicion about what kind of beliefs this band had towards.
No doubt.
There was one part of the book, I did make a note about it, but then I just kind of wrote it in my notes, that Debbie does allude to Ian's racism. like especially when he was drinking.
Oh.
Yeah, so of course, like that's these are some things that are not really well-known facts about Joy Division or Ian Curtis. And I feel almost like I was saying, for those people who are very devoted to him and who idolize him, that, you know, like he idolized other people.
Yeah.
They I feel like that kind of part of him was very just brushed to the side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly would never dream of calling my band Joy Division for someone who is like extremely against all that. I don't think anyone would. It's not super shocking that he's like slightly racist.
Yeah.
And I'm saying slightly, I don't know. I'm just hoping it's slightly. Not that that makes it any better, though.
No.
No.
For the record, I, Shanti, am against Hitler and for sex work. I just
want to
let that be known. Their first gig as Joy Division was on January 25th, 1978. That's my birthday.
Nice.
And that was exactly 10 years before I was born. Oh. So just want to say that. Not actually feeling that great about it after we just talked about the whole Hitler thing, but moving on. Even though they were only paid 60 euros for the entire band, people were still taking their set list. Like, people were like, oh, this band already is going to be big, so I'm on it.
Interesting.
They decided to have a baby because Ian was very much... He had a hard time saying no to anybody. So he had a hard time with confrontation, and he had a hard time with anything like that. So if he did say something shitty about somebody, they would accuse, like they would ask him about it later, and he'd be like, I never said that. Hmm. He's one of those guys. He put a lot of blame on a lot of other people, and he never took a lot of responsibility for his own stuff. But Debbie wanted a baby, and so he wanted to make her happy, so he said okay. Peter Hook said that one of the problems with Joy Division is that they kept their relationships at arm's length and so did not share any happiness. It was almost like with the band, it became unfashionable to be happy.
Hmm.
So working with Tony Wilson and Rob Gretton, Tony Wilson financed a factory sample EP, which had the songs Digital and Glass. In 1978, when Debbie became visibly pregnant, Ian had his first epileptic fit. A lot of his independence was taken from him at this time, as you can imagine, because they're confused about, like, when, why this is happening. Yeah. And so every time he went somewhere, like, including going to the bathroom, he had to tell somebody or tell Debbie. And, of course, this would not help anybody's kind of depression.
No. No, absolutely.
Yeah. The band was becoming more and more in demand, and in 1979, Ian appeared on the cover of Enemy in the famous green coat smoking the cigarette, which I believe is the cover of the book. Bernard had been aware of Ian's manic personalities, which got even worse with the medication. His moods would fluctuate between ultra politeness and blind rage. One minute he was high, the next he was crying.
Did Ian know the band members before creating the band?
I believe they all ran in the same circle, but he had put out an ad for a band, somebody answered, and then there was the three of them until they found their drummer, and that was the last bit of Joy Division coming together.
Gotcha.
No more questions. Just kidding. I didn't do a great job answering that, but
no,
she does talk exactly about how the book is formed or how the band is formed in the book, but moving on. So Debbie did everything she possibly could to help him organize his life and reduce any stress that he might be under. She said that his dancing had become a distressing parody of his offstage seizures. His arms would flail around like a winding an invisible bobbin. And it seems like it was kind of a what came first, the chicken or the egg, because he danced like this at the engagement party years ago.
It was in him.
And so if you feel one way or another about like illnesses and stuff, that maybe that they lay dormant.
Yeah.
And that eventually, like, it's just a matter of time before something triggers them anyways.
Interesting.
now that he's taking this medication, his moods are even worse than before. And it doesn't seem like when she was listing all of the medications that he was taking, that he was on any kind of antidepressant or mood stabilizer and anything like that, because I'm not sure really how common that kind of stuff was. It was diagnosed back
then, yeah.
Then, like, he didn't seem to be getting very much help.
He doesn't sound like the type who would go to the doctor and say the words, "I'm depressed," anyway.
Yeah, or maybe even try to make an attempt to be better, because it was very...
I'm an artist.
Early on that he... Yeah. That suited him.
Yep.
Like, it was later on that everybody in the band and Debbie would say that Ian's melancholy was staring them in the face. Mm-hmm. Unknown Pleasures was recorded at Strawberry Studios in Stockport in April of 1979. And whether it was intentional or not, she says the wives and girlfriends had gradually been banished from all but the most local of gigs, and a curious male bonding had taken place. The boys seemed to derive their fun from each other. Hmm. So no more girlfriends and wives.
Yeah. And people have to remember, this is like, they're like 20, right?
Yeah.
They're young, so...
Now, that's an interesting question, because of course we know that this happened with the Beatles. It's happened with a lot of bands, giving the aura of availability.
Yeah.
But would you ever not like a band, say even like in your younger years?
If you knew
that they had wives?
No.
Does that make a band less appealing?
Not to me.
Do single band members make bands more appealing?
It's an interesting
thing. Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, I think little girls are going to have their fantasies whether or not they're married.
Yeah.
I mean, there are fan fiction out there about people who are dead. That doesn't make them less appealing. Like,
that's true. Yeah.
What you want them to be in your fantasy.
Let's talk about Instagram again. There has been times, I think, where I've gone on like a band's Instagram and then found like an individual band member's account and then gone to check and been like, so how often is the girlfriend or the wife present in those pictures? And it's just interesting what people tend to share online in terms of that kind of stuff.
It's a different world now, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Cynthia Lennon wasn't posting pictures, and Debbie. None of these women were.
Poor Debbie. So their daughter was born. And because of his epilepsy, Ian was very reluctant to hold his daughter, even under supervision. If Natalie was crying, Debbie had to serve Ian first, almost as if he was demanding his turn for attention from her. And she referred to him as acting like a jealous child.
Yeah, two babies.
Yeah. The band was better than ever, and this point had a serious following. There was a time at a local gig where she stood admiring them in the audience, thinking that the depressive image and lyrics were all a part of the act. She was self-satisfied. She was happy to see him, but happy in her ignorance, which she stayed in that for quite a while and in many different ways. Ian continued to have many grand mal attacks, as much as four in one night. She does talk about their idyllic nights together that they spent walking Natalie and their dog Candy.
There were nice moments in between.
Yeah, there were.
Yeah.
Mick Middles reviewed a Factory gig comparing Joy Division's songs to an orgasmic experience. He said, "During the set's many peaks, Ian Curtis often loses control. He'll suddenly jerk sideways and, head in hands, he'll transform into a twitching epileptic-type mass of flesh and bone. Suddenly he'll recover. The guitars will fade away, leaving the lonely drummer to finish the song on his own. Then, with no introduction, the whole feeling will begin again. Another song, another climax."
Wow.
So then the groupies started.
Of course.
But before we get to that, Ian wasn't making a lot of money and would do things for Factory Records. So their band was with them, but then he would also kind of work for them to pick up money on the side to make extra cash, because the royalties were being split four ways.
Yeah. He had a family to support.
And he had a family, and he was doing a lot of the lyric writing, of course. And then the, yeah, that like, that guitar sounds good with this, but still four ways. And again, it could go back to the, like, well, Ian had a hard time standing up for himself, saying no.
Yeah.
He just didn't. Yeah. And ultimately, like, it'll come out too, where he's not putting his family, he's not putting his family first.
Mm-hmm. The groupies. Oh.
Yeah. So by this point, wives and girlfriends were totally banished. Young female fans were showing up backstage a lot, hanging out with them. And she said by August of 1979, Ian was famous. The husband and father ceased to exist. Any plans that he made them with Rob. Yeah. Meanwhile, she was at home just trying to, like, make sure that his life was good and that he had his shelter and he was taken care of and that their baby was good. And
it's a foolish thing to get married so young, in my opinion. I know some people do get married young and stay together, and that's fantastic. But the majority, you are still a kid at 20, even though you feel like an adult.
Yeah.
You are a kid. Enjoy those years.
Yeah. So she says that it was okay for the girls, the girlfriends and the wives, to boost the numbers in the early days by being at the shows. And it was taken for granted that they would iron clothes, pack cases, and make excuses to employers. But now it seemed that they were bad for the image. Mm. Jugs were becoming more accessible too. And at this point, all of Ian's spare time was spent reading and thinking about human suffering.
It's interesting the wives not being allowed, like we were talking about. It's interesting because it really brings out the fact that these men were concerned about the image. It's not like all about the music, man. Like, the image clearly mattered to them too, if they're thinking, well, maybe we can, like, maybe people will like us more. Like, we just pretend we are not married. And
yeah,
you know,
I mean, otherwise, these guys would have done that thing. They would have had the girlfriends and the wives at age 19 and 20 and stayed with this one person pretty much their whole lives or half their lives. And then maybe they would, like, I don't know, marry one other person. Like, that was the typical. And now they're realizing, like, that's, we're rock stars now.
Yeah.
And that's a thing. So that's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. She started to feel disdain from him, not able to communicate between them at all beyond what kind of sandwich he wanted to eat. And she said it was around this time he got the lead singer syndrome, just like not showing up places and just, you know, whatever.
I'm the most important person in the room.
Yeah. They played a show in Leeds, and someone in their book wrote about the show. It was one of those rare occasions that the band's wives and girlfriends were seen at a Joy Division concert. But Debbie goes on to say, neither myself, Sue, nor Iris were there, so I'm not quite sure to whom he was referring.
Ouch.
That's what I wrote! In my own note, I just wrote,
ouch.
Ouch. Yeah. So his overprotective attitude faded towards her. When she asked him about groupies, he said, as if I could, I'd probably have a fit. But he did admit that Bernard was in the habit of bringing girls back to the hotel room and for them both and pushing Ian to sleep with them.
He made me do it.
Yeah. So there's a good example of, remember I said earlier, of Ian really not taking responsibility for his own actions.
Yeah.
On October 16th, 1979, at a show in Brussels, that's in Belgium, he met Annick Honoré for the first time. Mm-hmm. The band had told Debbie about a chubby Belgian girl who was a tour manager, but Steve Morris said she was possibly a journalist. Debbie was like, she definitely wasn't chubby, and she worked for the Belgian embassy. Okay. But in the movie, that's essentially how they portray her having a first conversation with Ian, was that, oh, she just writes for a fanzine, but she wants to do an interview. Mm-hmm. And then in the movie, she's sitting there trying to interview the members of the band, and they're all being very, like, they're being dickheads.
Yeah.
And it was known that Joy Division gave really shitty interviews. Mm. Like, they wouldn't answer any questions. They'd be like, well, we just want people to listen to the music and figure it out for themselves. We're not going to tell you anything. Anik had quite an influence on Ian and almost convinced him to become vegetarian. This is another relationship that was really, really, really romanticized in the movie. And I know a lot of guys who had seen that movie that were like, oh my God, I'm so in love with the Anik character. She's just your perfect group, your perfect groupie. But really, when it comes to it, she was very controlling to him. She was even at a couple of gigs that Debbie was at, but Debbie didn't know about her.
Oh, that's
so
awful.
She would just kind of be there watching what was going on. And I mean, we're so groupie positive in this. I'm not saying, like, I don't mean to. It's just that this whole thing is depressing. Like, the whole book, the whole situation.
You know, things happen, and they're all really young. People make mistakes in life. People do things at 20 they wouldn't do at 30. You know?
Yeah, I hear that. So they had hardly no money at this point, and like the dog could barely eat and was getting sick. So Ian didn't really care if there was enough money for food, but he took money out of Debbie's wallet for cigarettes anyways. Like, that's what kind of guy he was. In January of 1980, they went on a European tour, and while Debbie was barely able to, like, keep it together with their kids, Ian and, well, Joy Division was paying for Nick's accommodations.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's actually...
Ian told his bandmates how unhappy his home life was and blamed a lot of things on Debbie, which made it seem like the relationship with Nick was justified. Again, girlfriends and wives were banned from shows and touring, but Anik didn't seem to fit into either one of these categories, and she was actually quite welcomed from the band. Right. Which is weird, because, like, when I think about, like, so one thing that they did too is they would book, like, two hotel rooms, and everybody from the band would have to stay in one room, and then Debbie and Anik would stay in the other room. Remember, this was
you
one
mean Ian and Anik.
Did I say Debbie and Nick? I wish. That would have been nicer. Those two should have just been like, let's ditch this bozo.
Exactly.
And so Ian and Nick would take one room. I remember there was this one time I was on tour with the band, and we stayed at my friend Joel's house in his apartment, and he only had one bedroom, and it was his bedroom. So when it was time for everybody to kind of go to sleep, I was going to sleep on the floor with all of the band, but it was my first night that I had seen this guy since he came into town, so yeah. I was kind of like, can we take your room?
Yeah.
And bless him, he was like, okay. So it's kind of a weird thing, like, okay, all of the band, you guys go here and we're just gonna go in this room. And
I find it interesting, like, that the band was paying for Anik, like,
yeah,
for their separate room.
Yeah.
When I've been on tour with bands as well, If a band member wanted a separate room for whatever reason, like, he was paying for it out of his
for
own
sure.
pocket.
Yeah. Heck, I've even been like, you guys want some gas money?
No.
They'd be like, no, Shanti, we got this. Your presence is payment enough.
Exactly.
Okay. So, soon enough, Debbie discovered Anik's name and number in a notebook, and Ian admitted to it. At first, she accused him of being with another man. Did I mention in my notes earlier that he would take her to gay pubs?
No.
Okay, so you can see where I'm on a little bit about this kind of
stuff.
Interesting. But then they had a laugh about that, and he admitted to having an affair with Anik. While his personal life was disintegrating, his career was flourishing and his voice was getting even better. Things got particularly cruel when all of the wives were invited to a show in London, and Debbie said she couldn't afford to go to a hotel, but actually the hotel for the wives had been paid for, and Ian just shrugged. So Debbie didn't go, and she just used the money to pay the bills at home.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so Anik would continue to be on tour with him. I believe that, like, even Anik was around when the other wives were around. So now at this point, like, Debbie's kind of the one being left out. And it's just, like, an embarrassing betrayal. Anik had the nickname of the Belgian Boiler because she would just, like, yell at everybody all the time about stuff. She got angry about them wanting to check into a brothel, like a hotel that also, like, was a brothel, because it was immoral, but they're like, you're dating a married man.
Yeah.
So she would, like, blow up at them. Ian supposedly ended it with her
at one point,
but Like, not really.
Yeah.
Ian was really giving a public display of his illness at this point, and it seemed that the sicker that he got, again, the more popular the band became. Debbie didn't know the extent of Ian's inner turmoil because she hadn't been allowed to listen to anything or read any lyrics since Unknown Pleasures.
Wow, he really cut her out of everything.
Huh? Yes. So Ian spent Easter with Nick that year, and then upon returning home to Debbie, he overdosed on his medication. The note that he left them was pretty terrible, or that he left for Debbie was pretty terrible. Just said, no need to fight now. Give my love to Anik. In hindsight, Debbie writes that suicide is 5 times more likely in people suffering from epilepsy. Plus, with his manic depression and all this stuff, it was just...
Was there... Like, did... Was that expected? Like, did they... Did it just happen so randomly, or...
Well, he had just come back from Easter with Anik, and apparently they had been fighting a lot. Debbie said that Ian's choice of Anik as concubine was disastrous, as she was unable or unwilling to give him comfort after he'd had an epileptic fit. Her embarrassed rebuffs hurt him deeply. So that's definitely something that's different from the movie, because there is a part in the movie where it seems that it shows that she's actually comforting him after a fit. They continued to play shows, tour, took no breaks, and sometimes he would just say that he wanted to leave Joy Division and join the circus.
After the first overdose, how did they... Did they pretend like it never happened?
Pretty much, and Ian was just like, oh, I was just like... I was just wasted. Like, I just, I was just, you know.
Okay. I gotcha.
Yeah. The video for Level Tear Us Apart came out in April 25th of 1980. His relationship with Nick was reported at this time as Ian behaving like an... you can tell me if I'm saying this right. Obsequious manner. Obsequious? Maybe I spelled that wrong. Which means just obedient towards her. And she in turn ordered him around like an obedient dog. He missed his first daughter, or he missed his daughter's first birthday. And at this point, Debbie started to become very angry about Anik. She says she had a sexy accent, a job at the Belgian embassy, and seemingly enough time to follow Joy Division around Europe.
I wanted to ask, did Debbie at any point ever consider leaving him?
Yes, but before they were married. We're getting here right now. She started talking about divorcing Ian. And one of her friends recommended waiting because they were just on the cusp of the kind of fame that brings in the real money. Because at this point, she's still not able to pay for shit.
Yeah, and she has a daughter to take care of.
So Joy Division played their final gig on May 2nd of 1980 at High Hall at Birmingham University. And they were set to fly out to America. So as we're nearing the end, we know that all of this stuff kind of accumulates and augments, whatever we want to call it, in Ian's suicide. So Debbie said that the morning that she woke up before she went to go find Ian dead in their apartment, This Is the End by The Doors were playing in her head. She woke up and that was the song that was playing. So there's a lot of kind of supernatural things that...
Yeah, they sort of have a connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she does describe finding him in the book, which just makes it all the more, like, sad and heartbreaking.
I bet.
Anik's tenacity was astounding, she says. She continued to call their house after he died.
After he passed?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. It doesn't really explain that.
Did they chat? Wait, did they talk about him?
She doesn't talk about that.
That's interesting.
It's like, really interesting.
It's either like harassment or they actually connected somehow.
Yeah. When he died, Anik spent days in the bed that she shared with Ian back at Tony's place, listening to Closer over and over and over nonstop all day. So... This is what Debbie says to kind of finish it off. The release of Closer brought with it a burst of realization for many of those already close to Ian. His intentions and feelings were all there within the lyrics. While he lived, they were equivocal, but with hindsight, all was disclosed when it was too late for anything to be done. Such a sensitive composition would not have happened by accident. For me, Closer was Ian's valediction and Joy Division's finest work. Mm-hmm. He cajoled us, nurtured us with his promises of success. After showing us what it looked like, he offered us a mere sip before he abandoned us. He abandoned us on the precipice.
Did he leave a note that time?
He did.
No.
Yeah. Which was taken by the police officers, but then returned to her.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Do you know what Debbie was up to after?
Good question. Yeah, good question. I mean, besides writing the book, it's
she's not really a public figure anymore.
No,
doesn't do much.
And yeah, I guess if she did, I get anything, you know, from Joy Division, because it all did go to her.
Yeah.
Because they never did go through with the divorce. He'd asked her to reconsider. He said, like, I do love you and all the stuff. So, like, I really wonder how much off of those two albums and, like, this movie and all of this, like, how much Debbie ever really received, or if, like, the myth of this band, or, like, the success of this band, or it's almost just, like, a legend. Like, their legend just...
Yeah.
Like, I wonder how much sales would have really been able to support her and her family.
I think a lot. I mean, if he wrote all the songs, he got a part of that. And like you said, I mean, you walk downtown, you're bound to see someone with a Joy Division t-shirt on, or they... The when the film came out, I'm sure there's another surge. And
hey, listen to this. Natalie Curtis is 38 years old. She is a photographer.
Oh.
Yeah. So look at these, like, pictures of her. She's beautiful.
Aw.
Wow. So there's an article about her, 2007. Natalie Curtis, daughter of Joy Division singer Ian Curtis, went on set, camera in hand, to find out. Oh, so she was... Initially, I was dead set against visiting the set of Control.
Oh, she went.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, I'll link up this article with
our
episode. Cool. Because it looks like it's really interesting. Yeah, initially I was dead against... visiting the set of Control, the film about my father's life, directed by photographer Anton Corbin. Although it took my mother's memoir, Touching from a Distance, as a starting point, books are read in private, whereas a film is something much more public and experience shared with an audience. When filming began in Macclesfield, I declined the opportunity to go. Macclesfield was somewhere I'd always associated with lush green rolling hills, and I didn't want to associate it with a film about my father's suicide. Gradually, my curiosity got the better of me, though. After all, I did study photography, and I am interested in film. Also, I felt that seeing the process would make it easier to watch the finished thing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. It's okay. Good to know she's an artist, too.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, yeah, this article's cool. I'll definitely link it up. So that was our episode this week about the book Touching from a Distance, written by Deborah Curtis,
once
the
again,
widow of Ian Curtis.
It's always better to be the groupie than the wife.
Ooh. Yeah.
Groupies have more fun, let's just say that.
That's true.
I mean, wives have fun, but the groupies never have to deal with the other shit.
Is that true?
Well, they don't have to.
Yeah,
I'm sure
you're
some
right.
do. But.
You're right. We should do. I wonder if we could come up with an episode, just like a mini of like at least 5 really successful rock and roll marriages.
I'm sure we can.
Even Sharon and Ozzy split up not too long ago.
I know. And the fact is, like, we never know what's going on inside a marriage, you know?
We don't, unless you write a book about it. And then we do know, and then we podcast about it and try our best to get the facts and all of the information right.
Yes.
And then apologize for talking about Instagram so much.
Exactly.
So that's it for today.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for being listeners. We love you.
We do.
And see you next week.
See ya.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.